Meeting will come to order. Representative Singlestead, I think, was at our last meeting. Would you move the minutes of Monday, February 25th?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move approval of the meeting minutes of February 25th.
Any additions, corrections, changes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a couple of pieces that our governor's initiatives are in the governor's bill and I think are reflected in the public safety recommendations we received yesterday. But we thought it might be helpful for the committee to know the background of it and why those recommendations were made. And so we have invited some people here today, Tim Leslie and Tim O'Malley. No, we don't have... Yeah.
Tim Sears.
Okay. All right. To give us an overview of the statewide master plan for fire and law enforcement training facilities and forensic lab advisory board report, and we're hearing first from Tim Leslie. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner, and good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to present information to you. I will be going through the basically about 9 years of information from 1999 forward and how we got to the point where we recommended Camp Ripley. Here with me is Don Beckering. He's from MNSCU, and Don is one of the original members from the study, the master plan study in 1999. And so he's here as kind of a reference point as needed, and he'll be talking about mobile training a little bit to a degree. Throughout the my presentation, I'm going to talk about emergency preparedness, but I'm going to bring up Rocco Forte, the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the City of Minneapolis. He'll be offering some insights. And then Eric Ulnus, who's a colonel with the National Guard, will talk specifically about Camp Ripley and why it's an important opportunity for us. This is the Department of Public Safety mission. The proposals we are recommending clearly fit within that mission. These are our divisions that we have at the Department of Public Safety. Our tagline or vision is making Minnesota safer. So everything we put in front of you, if it's not making Minnesota safer, then it's really not fitting our mission. The authority for the master plan study comes out of the 1998 session laws, and that's the quote there, Chapter 404, Section 21. It establishes an advisory committee that will advise the Commissioner of Public Safety. It was a 15-member committee, and their purpose was to advise the Commissioner on components of project design and content, specifically mentioned. This is the committee's methodology. They contracted with the Management Analysis Division at the Department of Administration to do the research and write the report. They held public meetings. They did a statewide survey. They did some tours, they reviewed the current landscape, and of course they did some background research. The recommendations from that master plan, and this is in your packet, you have a couple of big stacks of paper. One is the master plan, and then you'll have report number two. There's an article in a national publication about the City of Minneapolis, the bridge collapse. I have a checklist in there that I use to help me make these decisions. And then you'll have a tier, training tier concept definition as well. So the five areas, key areas that the group made recommendations to the legislature were to consider would be location and priority, the use of mobile equipment, the design of regional training centers, ownership, operation, funding, and capacity and usage. Under the location priorities, I think the key factor here is they wanted the legislature to know that the increased use of existing facilities is their number one priority. The number two is to expand or upgrade the existing facilities that were available. And the last option or priority was construct new. They put forth some guidance. Is it cost effective? Is it accessible? And of course, those are all rather subjective terms. New facility priorities, the master plan recommends that a needs assessment be done in the region that is applying for a training center. Another opportunity would be to examine the student population of the region and see what their needs are. And that's basically why I developed a checklist. You'll see that in your packet. It kind of helps you define those. One thing the training master plan recommended was the use of mobile equipment. And we're talking about driving simulators and mobile fire simulators. And Mr. Don Beckering, that's his expertise area. And if the chair is okay with it, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Beckering.
Please. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Don Beckering. I'm the state director for first responder education for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I manage what's called the Fire EMS Safety Center in the office of the chancellor. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. One of the things that the committee saw back in 99 was that in a lot of the areas of the state of Minnesota, the ability and distance of travel did not always make a central regional facility as feasible. And certain training needed to be brought to them. And because of that, the idea of mobile training props was brought into being. And again, if you take a look at Northwest, Northeast Minnesota, those distances were great. The Minnesota State College University's first responder programs have recognized this for many, many years, and the importance of bringing training to the first responder rather than always having the first responder coming back to us. And so back in 99, we already had mobile training props, roughly about 20 trailers providing different types of education for first responders, law enforcement, fire, and emergency medical services. Today, our fleet is almost about 80 trailers now that we utilize throughout the state of Minnesota, from anywhere from structural collapse to confined space to all kinds of different types of things that are there. So it really is important to take a look at the ability of taking in certain areas the fixed facility, which works extremely well, versus or in combination with the mobile facilities that are being provided.
Madam Chair, members, we'll continue on. I think if you look at what they did back in 99, the group, they were rather visionary. They talked about the use of technology and providing realistic training, a place where police officers, firefighters, and the discipline could make mistakes in an environment where no one would be hurt. And one of the changes we've seen since 1999, of course, is this area has expanded rapidly, the use of technology. And on the picture here, you can see what a simulation would look like in case of some sort of a disaster. It's what we call high risk, low frequency. You don't have many chances to respond to a bridge collapse, a tornado, or a flood. You must get your response done correctly. You don't have a second chance. And if you make mistakes along the way, people are going to be hurt. In terms of the recommendations for ownership, they wanted to give a high degree of consideration to those who are collaborating, and a cooperative agreement between federal, state, and local to deliver training. And then in terms of funding, there must be a plan for funding the operational costs of the training facilities and a marketing plan to maximize the use. This brings us up to now 1999. The legislature might have been a little disappointed in exactly all the recommendations that were delivered, and they redirected the Department of Public Safety to get that task force back together again, and they called for some specific recommendations. And that's in report number 2, you'll see. And those 7 recommendations are listed here. Specifically, which cities, counties, and regions would get a regional training center? Why would they be located there? What is the extent of the collaboration going on in that region? What's the appropriate funding match between the collaborators? What's the feasibility of providing the training? Can the need be met by current facilities? And they had a couple other issues as well. They talked about 8 regions, and I will actually have a map of those 8 regions. It's in your PowerPoint. They wanted one site per region, and they must meet the regional training needs of that region. Specific language taken from the report number 2. Interested parties must demonstrate collaboration to meet the region's training needs. And on page 4 of the report, clearly define multi-jurisdictional commitments to the proposal. Again, the cities and the counties that get together and collaborate to make these regional training centers work. for the region. The binding proposal must include a plan to meet the federal, state, and local requirements. I already mentioned the multi-jurisdictional, and also the 50% capital cost must be identified, as well as the 100% operational that the recommending unit of government would have to be responsible for. As we examine this area, especially as of late, and I assume probably at the same time the study was going on, this began to differentiate the needs of different student populations and disciplines. In particular, law enforcement and fire is where they began to diversify a little bit. Many of our firefighters are volunteer, and to ask firefighters to drive an hour to a regional training center in their pumper when they only get 3 hours of training once a week was seen as a little too burdensome for many of those volunteer fire departments. In law enforcement, those officers are working. They can take a squad car and drive an hour. It's not as big of a deal. So that's where we began to get some divergence, and that's where mobile training came to be a bigger idea for fire than police. Here are the 8 regions that were recommended. You can see that the metro area is divided into 3, Metro East, Metro West, and Metro South. The investment must address future impact of distance learning. They called it distance learning. We know it now as online. Actually, again, visionary. They're thinking ahead. They know that that's going to expand. And the facility must address the training needs of law enforcement, fire, and they do indicate other disciplines. This is a key factor here, primary principle. This is what is basically the foundation for the tiered training concepts that we use for when we start to study this again in 2006. But local training needs to accommodate basic training needs. The more basic the training, the more local it needs to be. When it becomes more specialized, it moves to the regional level. And when it becomes exceedingly specialized, that training needs to go at the state level and probably at one site only. Some of the challenges you'll see when you're looking at some of these bonding proposals, of course, is training centers competing against emergency operations centers. And some of the other concepts, of course, are not everyone can have one and not everyone can afford one. Ultimately, this is what the legislature funded. They have funded now 5 regional training sites across the state. You have the Merritt Center in Marshall. That was funded about a $1.2 million appropriation in, I think, the year 2000. Hutchinson, a similar year, was about $240,000. Edina, 2003, $500,000 to build their Tier 2 Regional Training Center. Ramsey County, 2004, $500,000 to build their regional firearms training facility. And then Scott County in the year 2006 was funded. And at that stage is when we decided we may need to take another look.
So just out of curiosity, your critique of that. After everything you told us up to this point, when the legislature mm-hmm. funded 5 regional training sites, how did they do in reflecting what you had all the
work I don't think they followed the recommendations of the study. You know, they did okay, but we could have done a little better. Let's put it that way. Okay. 2006, I testified to what I thought was a little bit of a haphazard approach to look at it. I recommended that we put a work group together, and that's what we did at Public Safety. And we began to get folks together. And this is our work group. It was the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, the Ambulance Association, chiefs, police chiefs, fire chiefs, and sheriffs. Got together our state stakeholders as well. You can see the BCA was there, Homeland Security, Fire Marshal, MNSCU, National Guard, and the State Patrol. We examined the 1999 report. We took some field trips, met and talked about what's changed since 1999, and they were along for the journey. It was pretty fun to be a part of that. and ultimately that was the group. Got letters of support from all those associations for the Camp Ripley proposal in your packets as well. And then we began to look at what's happened since and what are we facing here in Minnesota. And you can see then the storms we had in 07 in August. We had the bridge collapse, of course. That's the wrong date. That was 8-1, actually. The flooding, severe winter storms. I think we have 18 presidential disasters in the last 10 years. We led the Midwest. I'm not sure we want to lead the Midwest in that. I think Ohio recently surpassed us. That's good. But we're going to continue to have disasters. How best can we position the state to prepare all of our first responders and our emergency managers to be prepared for those kind of things? So our desire, from the group's perspective, was that every part of this state should have the same level of preparedness as the next. And, of course, that is a difficult task, but one we felt up to doing. We looked at, since the study, what's changed. And, of course, 9/11 changed the face of emergency preparedness. Katrina has changed the face. And the new incident management standards that we have to adhere to from the federal government, of course. The mobile driving simulators, the use of technology, all those things are coming into play. In 1999, you'll notice, if you read this study, we talked about police and fire, and maybe EMS to a degree. Nowadays, when we talk about emergency preparedness, it's about 10 disciplines. Government administration. We know that our elected leadership will be there. They better understand what's going on when they get there, what we're trying to accomplish. Police, fire, hazmat, EMS, public works, public health, transportation, public safety communications, the radio system that you funded so graciously for us last year, that was a critical factor during the bridge collapse, that they have to be at the table and have to understand what role they play in this, as well as health delivery systems. So the process we undertook, again, we reassessed the emergency preparedness training needs across the state. We looked at the original study, and we went back to what the original study said. Tier 1 is the most local, most basic training needs. It's the handcuffing. It's Firefighter 1. It's those things that can happen at the local unit of government, be it police, be it fire, EMS, whatever. Then there's the Tier 2, the specialized regional training. They train to a level that the region would respond to. If you have forest fires in your region, you should train for forest fires. If you have tornadoes in your region or floods, you should train for those kind of things too. You can also get that kind of training at the Tier 2 site. You can have a burn tower, you can have emergency vehicle operating courses, and shoot houses as needed. Then Tier 3, which is the Camp Ripley proposal, is actually a full-scale specialized training center in one location across the state. And with that, I'd like to bring in Rocco Forte, City of Minneapolis Emergency Preparedness Director, and talk about the lessons learned from the bridge collapse and the prior to that.
And Mr. Leslie, the committee already has a taste of the talents of Rocco Forte on the tour and the knowledge that you have and the leadership you have shown in recent months. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Rocco Forte. I'm the Emergency Preparedness Director for the City of Minneapolis. And I tell everybody when I have an opportunity to have the conversation that we would not have been successful in the bridge collapse 5 years ago. And that was because of training reasons, and I'd like to walk through there. On August 7th, 2007, the 35W bridge collapsed. There were 190 people on the bridge and 107 cars. We had basically every type of rescue scenario you could have. We had people that were trapped in their cars. We had vehicles that were on fire. We had individuals that were in the collapsed structure in the cement and the re-rod. We had individuals that were in the water, and we had individuals on the bank. That was a huge, complicated situation. And I'm going to talk about why we weren't able to do that 5 years ago. But in order to do that, I want to talk about where we were in 2002. In 2002, we basically applied for a grant through FEMA, and we went to Mount Weather, Virginia, with 60 people from the city of Minneapolis, 10 from the county and 10 from the state, to test our emergency operations plan. While we were out there, and during this test, FEMA sent individuals to the city of Minneapolis to identify what our capabilities were in training, what our staffing was, and what tools and equipment we had. So the scenarios they gave us about whether we could only use our actual resources and our actual plan. We had a mini chemical spill. We had a hazard, or we had a terrorist event at our convention center that had to do with bioterrorism. We had a high-rise fire at the IGS building. We had broken water mains where we couldn't get water. And then they had a tornado come through just as we were finishing up on the rest of it. And quite frankly, our plan was excellent, but we failed miserably. Our plan used best practices and it told us what to do, but we quickly identified that we did not have the tools, the training, or the relationships in the county and the state in order to get the resources on site. So we came back to Minneapolis in 2002 and we did a gap analysis of what went wrong in Mount Weather and what we would have to do to change that. And I can't stress enough how important it was to take those elected officials, department heads, all 10 disciplines that Tim talked about, go out to Mount Weather and be away from everybody for 4 or 5 days and have to work out this plan. And quite frankly, I enjoyed it very much as the fire chief at that time. Whenever we didn't have the tools or equipment, the reporters on site would ask our elected officials why they didn't put money into those processes, which made me feel good, quite frankly. But when we came back to do our gap analysis, we identified we didn't have the proper communication system. We had the same radio system that they had in New York, where the firefighters and police could not talk to each other. We had our emergency dispatch system was inadequate to move the resources around that it had to. We did not have a collapse structure rig in the state, or a collapse structure team, which meant we'd have to wait 48 to 72 hours to get that rig from another state if we did have a collapse structure. We did have not adequate hazardous materials teams or bomb squad teams. We did not have pharmaceuticals or a plan for pharmaceuticals if we had a pandemic or an incident. We had insufficient training in the incident command system and weapons of mass destruction. We did not have a continuity of government plan, and we had shortages of protective gear for all of our first responders. When we did our gap analysis 5 years ago, we identified it would cost approximately $65 million to close those gaps. But we immediately started looking at where we could find dollars through our taxpayers. We put $20 million into our radio system, and we put about $30 million to $35 million from grants from the state and the federal government. Based on that fact, in the 5 years from 2002 to the time the bridge collapsed, again, we put $20 million into 800 megahertz, which meant all of our first responders could talk to each other at the bridge that night. That was huge. Anybody that needed any resources, they were able to get on their radio and they were able to talk. We had 114,000 radio pushes in the first 6 hours of that event, and we were able to meet the demands of anybody who asked for resources. We would not have been able to do that 5 years ago. We had a computer-aided dispatch system that now has automatic vehicle locators on it and also has GPS so we could identify where there were open lots that we could move resources to, so when our incident commanders needed lights because it was getting dark, and generators or whatever resources they needed, we moved them up close to the site and they were minutes away rather than hours or days away. One of the biggest investments that we made with the city of Minneapolis and the county is invested $8 million into our collapse structure. That is extremely important to identify. Out of the 190 people that were on the bridge that night, 121 had to be triaged, treated, and transported. And about half those individuals had to be cut out of that debris. We were able to do that within the first few hours rather than waiting for 48 or 72 hours to have that equipment show up on site. We also put a plan together for our lack of pharmaceuticals when we came back. We now have stockpiling where we have pharmaceuticals for all of our first responders on site. We use pharmaceuticals for our 360 citizens within 12 hours. And we also have all of our planning needs met. I could keep going through this, but the key factor here is that we were able to get away, we were able to test our plan as a city and a community, and we were able to identify the shortcomings. But we had to go out to Mount Weather, Virginia in order to do that. If we could build that facility here in Minnesota, where we can take our communities off-site and we can go through emergency preparedness planning. We'll be able to identify the shortcomings in our emergency operations plan. We'll be able to do gap analysis, and the dollars that the state and the local governments do spend on their first responders and emergency management plans will be focused dollars that actually close gaps.
Murphy?
Thank you, Rocco. And Madam Chair, members, as we continue, someone brighter than me likes to say, my boss, an emergency is the wrong time to exchange business cards. And that's what we're after at Camp Ripley. We want to bring people together that would normally be together during a disaster and have those relationships built ahead of time. The what if would be talked about, the who's going to be on first when the stuff hits the fan, all those kind of things will be talked about ahead of time rather than at the scene when people need resources brought to them. And that concept basically is, as I was talking to Chris Idy, the Director of Homeland Security, I said, Chris, for example, the flood that we had in the Southeast, did every one of those emergency managers ever get together and talk about what it would be like during a flood? No. Well, that's exactly what Camp Ripley would fill the gap for. You could bring all your emergency managers together with your police chief, sheriffs, fire chiefs, emergency managers, all those folks to get together and talk about, okay, if it happens here, here's how we're going to respond. If it happens there, here's how we're going to respond. I have this resource I could lend to you. You have this resource you could lend to me. Are there states that are doing this? The only state I've been able to find with an emergency management training center that we're visioning for is something in Michigan. It's the closest model. It's unfortunately just more towards... I think it's more towards a fire-based or hazmat-based. Does not include all the disciplines as we would. And as I understand it, partners in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa would love to have the ability to attend our center at Camp Ripley. But one of the most beneficial parts of this is the fact that the military is going to be investing $19 million into a combined arms collective training facility at Camp Ripley. And we would be able to leverage what they're doing with what we want to do. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Colonel Allness, and he could explain some of those specifics to you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. And basically what we have a really good deal here for the state of Minnesota. As was mentioned, that we have almost a $20 million facility going into Camp Ripley, and it's going in this year. One of the later slides you'll see, it says that projected for this year and then continuing into 2012. But through the magic of congressional ads, the entire project will be constructed this coming year. But before I talk about that, if you look at what we already have at Camp Ripley, we start out with the ranges that go from smart arms to demolitions and go from stationary to moving targets. You look at our simulators, which are adaptive to shoot, don't shoot scenarios that work very well with law enforcement personnel. We have a shoot house that works very well for military people as well as our law enforcement emergency responders. So how do they enter and clear facilities if needed in a law enforcement circumstance, as well as a couple small cities already where we can do limited training. What this Combined Arms Collective Training Facility, or CACTAF, does, it provides us a small city that's fully instrumented and targeted and videotaped so you can do graduate level work with military or emergency responders and so forth. And with a nominal state investment, you can enhance this so it has the full benefit for the emergency responders as well as the military personnel. One of the things I want to talk about is at the Camp Ripley.
Representative Erdahl, was it to this point? Do you have a question to this point?
I don't like this one. Colonel, Madam Chair, Colonel, you mentioned the shoot house. Now, when you mentioned small towns, is that going to other towns to do this too, or simulation at Camp Ripley, or what color is that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. These are all residents at Camp Ripley. We have a 53,000-acre state-owned military post there, and most of those things are federally paid for and used training sites that the state can use at only operational incremental costs, so there's no maintenance costs and so forth. And just to add on that, too, if you look at the state additions that are going in, as appropriate and as desired by the state, there's a possibility we could put those on the federal inventory so the federal government would pay maintenance costs on it, and emergency responders would only have to pay the actual operational costs when they're on there, which is a very, very good deal. And then, of course, we as the military could use them as appropriate, too.
Representative Reynolds?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one brief follow-up. It is more for Commissioner Wesley. Looking at the statewide master plan, public safety training facilities dated 1999. Mm-hmm. Do we have a more updated list?
Mr. Leslie?
Madam Chair, Representative Riddle. No, we don't. I have not updated that list.
Representative Riddle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know about a lot of these others, but if you care, I can update you on Annandale sometime.
Love to, sir.
Colonel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just talk briefly about our partners. We've got a very good traditional partnership with the law enforcement already. The DNR and State Patrol do their academies at Camp Ripley. Many county and municipal law enforcement agencies already use Camp Ripley to great success, and the Department of Transportation does their snowfall training. That's just to mention a few of our state and local partners we have. And also, we have a very good working relationship with all these people. Our uses are very compatible. Just very generically speaking, the military uses it on weekends and law enforcement can use it in the week. So we find that the facility gets used a lot, but there's not a lot of conflict with our use time.
Have you anticipated that, though, the potential of conflict down the line or in the event of an emergency? Or?
Yes, Madam Chair. What we do is, we've worked very well, and it's been a rather informal relationship. We're willing to explore more formal relationships if needed, or if the state would want us to do that, we're certainly willing to do that. But also, there are benefits to co-use. As we're finding, if there is indeed a large-scale emergency, the guards there supporting the law enforcement already. So a lot of times we could do this. We could be using co-use. We might be training on slightly different things, but that the coordination, the partnership that we have to have would enhance the training experience rather than distract from it.
One would just assume if it's the military and the civilian using Camp Ripley, at a certain point the military might have a scheduling upper hand, I would think.
And Chair, one would think that, but if this is a state investment, then the state would have priority. As we look in the future as other potential additions, we've already looked into that and the coordination on the base principles of use, and if it was a state's investment, we'd look at state having first use of that facility, and that's something we're certainly committed to doing. These are our partners, and we don't want to impact the relationship by trumping just because some local military commander wants to use it on a certain weekday or something. So I don't envision that happening, ma'am.
Okay. Continue.
That concludes my briefing.
That concludes yours, and we have Representative Solberg.
I'm a little bit confused, I guess. In one of the slides, you showed all the buildings. Are those buildings that are proposed? Are they right there? Yeah. Where did that come from? Are they in existence?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a picture of the Fort Knox facility. This is very similar to what we will have.
Oh,
yeah.
This is our goal level.
That's what we will have will be roughly the same thing. I mean, if you look at the water tower there, that's actually where they have their control facility. We'll have our control facility, and from the stateside, their AOC will actually be off-site. But, you know, that's just kind of what they built into it. But that's pretty much what it'll look like when done, to give you a visual of what the gold standard is and what we will, in fact, have.
Well, ma'am, are the designs all done for these, architectural drawings done for these buildings?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have a complete design for what is required. It is mostly site adaptive. I believe it's at 65% design completion. We are designing in such a way that if the state should take advantage of this, that we'll be able to have the state integrate in and mesh with it, so that way we can take advantage of all those things. So we're leaving room in the design for the state to fit in as well.
And Master, clarify again when this is going to be under construction at Fort Ripley?
Colonel Almer.
If we don't do anything or if we do do something?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will be starting construction on it this year. As we said, we got $20 million this year to do the construction of it. You know, obviously, the sooner the better to make sure that the integration of this moves forward. But if the state decided to increment the funding of it over time, we just make sure that as we construct it, there'd be an opportunity to go in on the side. Although you would lose some efficiencies in construction, you'd also lose efficiencies in making sure you have a fully nested environment.
And I guess that leads up to my last question. If we could have some kind of a schedule of what that phasing might be.
Colonel
Almas. That would work.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll have to get that to you. But generally, we're completing the design, and then this summer we'll start construction. It'll be about an 18-month construction cycle. But I'll make a note to our agency to get that to the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Colonel Almas, I had a conversation with General Kelly before he left. And then I read the email that he sent to me. And he says in his email, I assume the facility would be transferred to the federal government. So how does that make Minnesota a priority participant?
Colonel Almas.
I'm Chair Representative. That goes back to my earlier statement. And again, there's nothing underhanded here. What we're trying to do is save the state maintenance costs of the facility. If there's a need for us to use on the military side, if we put it on, it's called the FISP, which is a federal inventory of properties, that allows us then to, through federal dollars, to maintain it. Now, we would remember where it comes from, just like our education center up Camp Ripley. It was funded a lot by state operations dollars, and I'm sure you can talk to the state patrol, and they feel that they receive fair and adequate use of that facility as one of the state agencies who are involved in the construction of that facility. As I said before, if the state felt more comfortable with a formal agreement to ensure that the state agencies would have priority on their portions of it, we'd be very happy to do that. We just haven't had a need to this time, nor have our state partners asked for that, but we would do it if required.
So that means Representative Tamar's bill might be easier to write in the future, operations costs down for the state.
Then
Representative Solberg. Representative Murphy, were you finished?
Sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, Colonel Almas, I guess not Colonel, but Madam Chair, the state doesn't operate the facilities. We don't operate the facilities that we've built as regional centers. The counties or somebody else does. So, in this case, Colonel, in this case then, if we built the regional center or the state center for training at Camp Ripley, that's owned by the feds, they would cover the operating. So we would only be responsible for the training?
Mr. Leslie?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, the way we've described it is they'd be responsible for staffing. Homeland Security Emergency Management Division of the Department of Public Safety would be responsible for staffing and as well as scheduling and putting together the training curriculum and things like that. However, we do want to partner with our local and county partners and have the spread the pain, spread the wealth, you know, have a cadre of people that would be trained to operate the center so that, for example, your training staff today is a Beltrami County deputy, a firefighter from the city of Rochester, and an emergency manager from the county of Manomet. You know, you'd have your training cadre as well as someone from the state. And so you'd have that local perspective in the room. It wouldn't just be the state folks, you know, people don't like that.
And Madam Chair, would we pay for that training cadre then out of Homeland Security funds that we get, the state gets?
That's to Mr. Leslie?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, no, this would be a state general fund appropriation that we'd be seeking next budget cycle to staff this facility.
Follow up?
Not at this time.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, maybe we counsel can help us with this too. I'm a little concerned that the Colonel said that if we build it, the federal government would take it over.
Then we have problems with the
bonding, I would think. Maybe council can help us with that then. And what they mean by ownership or take over, or would the federal government lease them? I think we could lease them probably to the, well, maybe we can't if they're bonding. Maybe council can help me with that.
Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, it is my understanding, and I'd want to go back and look at the bond council opinion letters again just to make sure, but it's my understanding that state GO bonds cannot be used for federally owned property. That's a constitutional issue, not a statutory issue. So whether we can do the leasing, I would want to look into separately from that. But federal ownership, we cannot use state GO bonds, to my understanding, for property that's owned by the federal government.
Colonel?
Madam Chair, and again, what we're trying to present is an opportunity to reduce the amount that the state would have to pay for the ongoing maintenance of the facility. I'll work with our council, too, to find out what are some of the things that we've done in the past to help facilitate this. And, of course, if it's not tenable, then that's just something the state would have to plan for, the maintenance costs as well as ongoing and rental operational costs of that. But we're comfortable with working whatever the state requirements are.
Anything further, Representative?
Well, then the other thing we should probably have some kind of an idea of what that ongoing operational cost might be. Okay.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Madam Chair, my questions are along the same line. And in the end, who ended up owning the education building? Because I recall, as one of you just testified, there were state dollars used. But I think it was maybe Mr. Leslie, or maybe the Colonel, but it sounded as though there were also federal dollars maybe involved with that education facility. And I guess, is it on the federal inventory list today, or is it remaining as a state entity?
Colonel Allman.
And Chair Representative, the education center was constructed with a mix of federal and state dollars. I think the majority of it was state dollars. And it was on the state inventory for an amount of time, and eventually was transferred to the federal inventory. So the federal would pay the maintenance costs for the facility, and that would be part of my investigation about the GO bonds and so forth, because I know that there was legal review when that was done to find out how was that all done to make sure that the rights and interests of both entities were protected and watched out for in that transfer.
So, Madam Chair, would that transfer have taken place after the bonds were retired, or would it have been before? Maybe you don't know the answer to that at this point. It's been a few years. Was here when we built it, but I don't recall just exactly how long ago.
Madam Chair, Representative, sorry, I don't have that information on me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question of Colonel Almas. I'm looking at Representative Paymar's bill and then contrasting it to the governor's bonding bill that was released. And there's some different wording, and you know, maybe we'll get into some of this stuff in conference committee too.
Well, Representative Paymar is here, so if there's a question about language, he's able to answer the question also.
Well, I guess I'm interested in the specific $5 million, what it covers. I see one bill talks about a collapse structure, the other one is a classroom, field response training. And then maybe if they could comment on that, yeah.
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Representative Singleton, correct. This is a phased approach. The first phase, the $5 million, will build a emergency operations center with an auditorium, two classrooms, and then there will be two field exercise areas. One is a collapsed structure rescue facility or site, and then a trench rescue site. I think that's it.
And then to follow up,
I'm sorry.
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Representative Singleton. And then fire hydrants. One of the key factors is if we get in at the right time, we can put in fire hydrants into this city that they're building, because soldiers don't need fire hydrants, but we, for the firefighter community, do.
Representative Singleton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the governor's bill, it talks about any unspent portion of this appropriation may be used for pre-design for phase two. I don't see that in Representative Hamar's bill. I mean, it sounds like, how far does the $5 million go? Is there leftover money for pre-design on the phase two?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not familiar with that language. I'm sorry. We anticipate spending all the $5 million for that, what we're trying to build.
And then just one final...
wishful thinking.
Madam Chair, in Representative Paymar's bill, it has about how non-military public service safety personnel from Minnesota will be given priority access to the training facilities. Any fees charged to non-military public safety personnel from Minnesota or their employers may not exceed the fees charged to military personnel and units that use the facilities. And so it sounds like it's in line with...
And my understanding was that was kind of comfort language of what everybody agreed had been negotiated. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure about that, but we're certainly comfortable with that. And actually, by federal law, we are unable to charge more than the specific operational incremental cost. So even if we wanted to charge more, we're limited by law from doing that federal law. So we're certainly comfortable with that part of language as well.
Further questions? I think that is it, and we have a few more slides now on this.
Madam Chair, members, yeah, we're almost complete here. Basically, this is our Emergency Management and Disaster Training Center at Camp Ripley. It's centrally located. Again, to reiterate what Rocco Forte and Colonel Ulnis has already stated, it's a way to plan, train, and exercise to meet national priorities and our local and state responsibilities. Available to local jurisdictions and our private and non-for-profit partners. 85% of our critical infrastructure across the state is not owned by the public, but owned by private industry and our private partners, and they would be able to participate with us. And also it may benefit other states as well. We would offer simulation-style training, the ability to make mistakes without anyone getting hurt or injured, with assurance that the national and statewide standards would be achieved. This would be the only place like this in the upper Midwest. And I would ask stand for any questions if you have any.
Any further questions, Representative Dunphy?
Well, obviously the $64,000 question is, if we do Ripley, which is obviously probably preferred by everyone, and you obviously have housing there, and they have the state-of-the-art training. And question is, how much less then do we have to even consider doing anymore in some of these regional locations other than some local training? I mean, we've got people asking for drive courses, and we've got people asking for shoot houses, and we've got people asking, while it's nice to have everything within an hour time, I suspect if you can take a crew up there periodically, you have the housing to stay overnight, that's not a problem, and the uniformity of the training, all the factors you've given there, the less cost of maintenance ultimately, and all the things. Are you going to, and Erdahl or some, Representative Erdahl or someone asked when this was last updated, 99, isn't it time we update now and say, if we go here, then what do we really need? In the state beyond that, and identify those regional needs again.
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, yes, I think that would be appropriate to update the study. We're not hesitant to do that. We'll take direction to do that if you'd like and give you an updated version at your wish.
And again, Madam Chair, and the reason I ask that is, frankly, I can't remember now, either my police chief or fire chief worked with your group and came back to me and said, if you do Ripley, we're satisfied that covers our needs. We're not looking at anything else regionally, at least out in the southwest part where we're at. They said that would, And so I'm starting to get some feedback from people that is the way to go. But again, it'd be nice again then to update and say, here's what we can do at Ripley, here's what we need locally, and that's it.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, along the same lines, I take it from your presentation that focus has been on the Ripley central location for the whole state, and that you really don't have a series of recommendations to make relative to all the regional centers, where they might be located, what services might be provided. Is that correct?
Mr. Lundy?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, we also are recommending in the governor's proposal Olmsted County as a regional 2 site, which is in the southeast. They have a population of well over 300,000 people within 50 miles of that city, a lot of full-time law enforcement, full-time fire, that aren't getting the training necessarily to fit the needs of their the expectations of the community, so we recommend that one as well. So that was part of our package.
Bill Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the other regions of the state are not yet really developed in terms of proposals.
That's correct.
That's correct. If I might make a suggestion here, I don't know how you settled on the regional map, but to me it would make a whole lot more sense for my home county, Clay County, and Becker County, located to our east,
mm-hmm.
To be a part of the West Central region. We already have all kinds of ties. We've got cities, counties that are working together on sharing equipment, specialized kinds of equipment. They have agreements going. It makes no sense at all for those two counties to be associated with the Northwest region. And the other thing I would say is that, my home city of Moorhead already is a regional training center with HAZMAT, and, we've got the most extensive police and fire and emergency personnel operation in the whole western half of the state. So, it seems to me that we would want to take advantage of facilities that are already up and running and making sure that we use those existing facilities to meet our more regional needs.
Response. I have Wiginius Murphy, Leader Erdahl. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your testimony is reminding me of a conversation that I had about 10 years ago with folks in the State Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was why they didn't have women in their training class at that time. And their answer was, well, we train at Camp Ripley, and it's too far away. Women can't leave their families, and so that's why we don't have women. Help me out on that issue.
Mr. Leslie. That was 10 years ago. Would someone answer the question the same today?
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, the State Patrol clearly has women, and I don't think the women that are joining the State Patrol have that concern any longer. They sure come up to Camp Ripley.
Then tell me, what was the percentage of women in the last State Patrol class?
Well, let's see. I think, Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, I think we had 5 out of 26, if I'm not mistaken. Is the commissioner in the room? You can help me a little bit. Was that about right?
Sure. Well, it's my recollection that about 50% of the population are women. So that's not a very satisfying answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, I would have to agree. And I think the State Patrol and Colonel Donatsky is held accountable to recruiting from all sections of the citizenry of the state. And he continues to try every trick in the book to try to get women attracted to the State Patrol. And we are competing against Minneapolis, St. Paul, sheriff's offices to try to get those quality people attracted to our State Patrol jobs.
I can follow up.
Virginia?
That's what I heard 10 years ago. So it's something is not right. Something is not working. State Patrol, just as an example, is a well-paid, well-respected job, and a very competitive job, and it should be. So something is not right here. Are you having your facilities that will be able to accommodate either men or women who have child care responsibilities?
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Representative Media, I'm not sure about whether they can accommodate child care responsibilities. I don't think we have that at Camp Ripley. However, I do know we had a conversation recently about job sharing with the State Patrol, which I think is something that law enforcement, frankly, would shudder if they heard. And for State Patrol to do it, I think is even greater. I do know that Colonel Banaski would be willing to meet and talk about his efforts to try to get more women into the State Patrol at any given time. You know, should you want to do that. But we are, it is a competitive marketplace right now for women officers.
Okay, the basic question here is, both men and women have child care responsibilities, and sometimes they don't have a partner that shares those responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And because you're asking people to come to a central location, will you be making accommodations specifically, or have you even thought about doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, there's no doubt we could make accommodations for child care at Camp Ripley. I'm not sure if Colonel Allness could speak to that issue, if that is available there, but that would sure be a possibility. I think one of the things that's attractive about Camp Ripley is, at least from the metro, you can turn that around in one day. You know, if you want to run up there, leave at 6 in the morning, you get there by 8, you do your training, and you can turn around and be back by 6 o'clock in the evening. You can't accommodate that type of training that we want to offer at Camp Ripley except to fly to the East Coast. There is no other training like this that we're hoping to offer. And that's one of the values, is that we could keep our people near in-state and much more efficient, much less cost, and that's what we're really after here.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Leslie, I appreciate that about what you're saying about the cost, and I think that's very important. Are they going to have to bring their pumper trucks to Camp Ripley? Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, our vision would be we would get donated equipment. And the fire service is very interested in that concept and the partnership. So rather than drive your pumper truck from wherever you're driving it from, you would get there and there would be pumper trucks at Ripley that you could use. May not be exactly like what you use at home, but from the hose, the hydrant, it would be the same.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Leslie, could you put those two maps up that you had before, the one with the training centers and then the one with the 8 regions?
The funded one. You want the 8 regional one?
Those were the 8 regions, and then... Madam Chair, Commissioner Leslie, would Ripley be the training center then for the central area? Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, we see Ripley as being a statewide operation, of course, for everyone, number one, but it also could serve as a regional, or a tier two type center for the central part of the state as well. So you would have the ability to go there and qualify with your firearm, go on emergency vehicle operating course, and you'd have all the tier two type capabilities that, for example, Rochester and Olmsted are trying to gather right now through this committee. You'd have those at Camp Ripley also. You'd have both tier two and tier three availability there.
For police, but what about fire?
For fire as
fire
well.
Fire too?
You'd have a burn tower, correct.
Okay, because of the burn tower.
Mm-hmm.
A representative leader. And then, I'm sorry, Representative Burns.
No, the other map with the training sites already in the map. Okay. And then you're recommending also that we have Olmsted County down there.
That's correct, ma'am.
And then where on that approximately would Ripley be?
I think Ripley would be, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. I think it would be if you went parallel to Duluth and then down about a fingernail.
A fingernail below Duluth.
Above Hutchinson.
Well, I know that when I drove to Ripley a long time ago, it took almost 3 hours. And I know that from Northwest it takes almost more than 1 hour, certainly, so then I would think it would take more than 3 hours, because there's no big highways that go directly by. But so you're saying that we'll have all these plus Olmsted, and then Ripley will be the state site, state central site. Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, members, correct. At this stage, that's what the work group felt was very strong about. That's what to us is one of the greatest needs across the state. That doesn't preclude another site, another regional training site across the northeast or northwest from emerging, based on the study from 99 and 2000. And if you want me to update the sites currently to bring that up to 2008, then we could do that as well.
I think we should. And then also a prediction of yearly dates on when the whole north above the central area would have the 800 megahertz, so everybody can talk to each other when there's an emergency, because that's our mission. Make Minnesota safer, and that's all of Minnesota, northeast, northwest. Megahertz are wonderful. We wouldn't have had it 5 years ago. I heard that.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Scott Wiggins, he's your guy. I know just enough to be dangerous, so be careful. I think his target is 2012, to have everybody that's wanting to come on the 800 megahertz system to be on, and to have all the sites built. Now, prior to that, I think in 2010, they're going to try to MnDOT, in cooperation with the DPS, is going to try to turn on as many sites as we have. And for many counties and cities, that'll be better than what they have now. So I'm hoping for some incremental success as we go towards 2012.
And Representative
Murphy. Leslie, when do you anticipate phase two of the Ripley plan would go into effect?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, 2010.
And phase three?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there is no phase three.
There is no phase three. So Marshall is still going to be ahead of Ripley.
Representative Murphy, correct.
Okay. We have Leader and Erdahl, and then we're going to have to get our last two people up here. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Commissioner Leslie, I know there's only one component, the fire unit, but I know the fire, you call them fire companies up in northwestern Minnesota, are not happy with the regional proposal up there. Do they have any input with your organization when you determine what it's going to be? Apparently,
sure.
You have an organization, at least up in our area, where all the small fire companies meet together, and they have informed me that they're not happy with the suggestion for the regional area that they would have up there. And maybe that's not your suggestion. Maybe it's someone else's.
Madam Chair, Representative Leader, they're not happy with the Gonvic Regional Training Center proposal. I have not had a conversation with them about that. The concept, of course, it breaks down on occasion, is that with the fire chiefs at the table, the Fire Departments Association at the table with me throughout this process, that there would be ongoing conversations between representatives in the regions and with their fire chiefs, and they would be getting me feedback if they were not happy with where we were going. So I suspect that not hearing that and that having that that buy-in from the Fire Departments Association, the Fire Chiefs Association, that they were okay with the Camp Ripley proposal. I did not solicit information or recommendations from any associations about each individual proposal that we received for regional training centers.
It was not Camp Ripley, it was just the local and not the Camp Ripley.
Yep. Yeah, correct.
Representative Erdahl, and then we'll have to get our last two.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Leslie, echoing again, as I started earlier, the appreciation of doing an update on this. I appreciate the extensive plan for Camp Ripley, but I'm hoping that you're not discounting the roles of smaller communities across the state that already have existing facilities and I referenced Annandale earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, you may guess that I represent Annandale.
Yes, sir.
And they do have a shoot house, and it is used by states across the country that come in for just, you know, shoot house training.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, certainly see the need for more extensive in Camp Ripley or wherever, but, you know, Annandale quotes the metro area. I think that type of facility still should have a place in your plan.
Sounds like a comment. I would just note Representative Doty, author of the bill, and Representative Tamar, chair of this particular area, are both in the room. And if you hear a question that you particularly wanted to address, you certainly should come down. We thought this was going to be 15 minutes, and of course there was far more interest in this committee than we had planned for. But we should get the Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management down to the table, and Sheriff Borchert from Olmsted County. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Idy, and I'm the Director of...
Sorry. Didn't pronounce your name.
Oh, that's okay. I'm the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and I'm here today to present to you our proposal for a pre-design for the State Emergency Operations Center. This pre-design is part of the Governor's recommendation and actually went through as part of the admin, the Department of Administration, bonding request in the governor's recommendation, but because it ties so closely with the other things that you're hearing today, we wanted to make sure that we present this proposal to you. The governor is recommending $500,000 for a pre-design for the State Emergency Operations Center in his bonding bill. It's because our existing facility could impede effective emergency operations because we have quite a few limitations in our physical facility. The benefit for this is that right now we are leasing space in downtown St. Paul, and this would be an owned building. We would be better positioned for disaster response, and this pre-design could show us the potential for co-location of our emergency operations center with other state agencies, and in particular possible co-location with the National Guard, who has recently received $3.5 million from the federal government to look at designing their joint force operations and their EOC. An emergency operations center is a physical location where various agencies, and in this case various state, federal, and private and non-governmental organizations, get together to coordinate information, to coordinate their support for this incident management activities that are happening during an emergency. The State Emergency Operations Center is maintained and managed by our division, which is Homeland Security Emergency Management within Public Safety. A lot of people are unaware of what an Emergency Operations Center really is. We coordinate the state agency response, we communicate with local emergency operations centers, and we communicate with the scene and the federal government and our private partners. We provide logistical and information support to the scene, and we coordinate public information from our State Emergency Operations Center with a joint information center specific to any given disaster. Every state, according to federal guidance, must have one primary and one alternate EOC. And there are several classifications that we have to look toward, and that's survivability, security, sustainability, interoperability, and flexibility. Some of the characteristics of survivability is that it's located outside of known risk areas. It can't be located in a floodplain, it can't be in a port security area, it can't be by a major rail line that carries hazardous materials. It has to be away from mid and high-rise buildings. And how they define that is a mid-rise is anything from 4 to 7 stories. A high-rise is anything over 7 stories. You have to be 10 feet away from a building for every story that you have around you. We are between a 27-story building and a 32-story building in downtown St. Paul. It might be interesting to note at this point that in 1993, in the first World Trade Center bombing, the New York City Emergency Operations Center was in the basement by the parking ramp. It destroyed a wall in their EOC. After that bombing, they moved into a new location, which was 7 World Trade Center. So the day the Twin Towers came down, the emergency operations staff had to evacuate their building, and that building collapsed at 1:45 p.m. So that is the hazard that we are in downtown St. Paul. It's a recommendation that we be below ground, that we can withstand hazards such as an EF3 tornado and a small explosion, and that we have protection systems in the Emergency Operations Center to protect our own staff from chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear agents. Security. We have to be 80 feet from any parking facilities. We need to have indirect entrances, such as a serpentine driveway or protected doorways. There should be barriers. There should be cameras. We should have adequate access control, and we should have monitoring of all of our ingresses and egresses. We also have to make sure that we have secure information and communication systems up to and including a specific site, a specific room inside of an EOC. Again, an owned versus a leased building, dedicated versus shared space. A state emergency operations center should be dedicated to be an emergency operations center and not be somebody's office that has to then, at time of a disaster, be turned around into an EOC. We must have redundancies. We should be able to have two different areas where we have the HVAC system in case we have a chemical that goes down to the ground or a chemical that goes up in the air. We should have them on opposite sides of the building. We should have the different switching stations so that if a communication switching station is damaged in one part of the city, we can still communicate. And we have to have 24/7 generators, not on only our life safety, but also on all of the functions inside the EOC. And it's highly recommended that we have adequate bunking, feeding, and exercising facilities in the State Emergency Operations Center to care for the responders who will be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Interoperability, we need to have clear communication sight lines. We need to have the various capabilities of communicating. We have to have secure encrypted lines, and we need to have the various different kinds of computer systems. Flexibility, again, dedicated versus shared space. We have to have adequate space for incident command system. And you heard Commissioner Leslie talk about the incident management of the training that would be held at Camp Ripley for incident management. Those people also have to get information from an EOC, so we have to also have this incident management system inside the EOC, which has to have adequate space for state responders, for federal responders, for non-governmental organizations, and we have to have adequate equipment and supplies. Here's some of our shortfalls. As I've said, we're in a high-risk area between two very tall buildings. The top picture is right outside of our door looking up. We're in a high-traffic area right in the middle of downtown St. Paul, adjacent to high-rises. The bottom right-hand corner, as you can see, we are in the food court. So when we have people visit us and they ask how to get to our facility, we tell them to go to Caribou and look kitty corner. And that's where we are. Right there, you're looking at the front door of our facility. Our security shortfalls is we are above ground. We are not below ground. We could be below ground, but then we would be right in the middle of a parking ramp. So when I said earlier that we had to be 80 feet from a parking ramp, we are right above the parking ramp, and we abut the Hilton Garden Inn in downtown St. Paul. We are one truck bomb away from being rendered useless. You can also see the Cedar Street entrance to our facility is glass doors. and the lower right hand is the drive-through to registration of the Hilton Garden Inn. If you open that door, it leads directly into our Emergency Operations Center. From a sustainability standpoint, we are in leased space, so our landlord not only controls our access, but also controls our HVA system. So we have no air filtration possibility. We only have one telecom entry, and as you can see from the upper picture on a weekend, Town Square is dead. Town Square is dead after 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and so there is no way of emergency responders other than bringing food from outside in, which is security issue in and of itself. Again, being between two large buildings, we are unable to have high-frequency radio transmissions, which is the way we would talk to the federal government in Washington, D.C. if other telephone systems were down. 800 megahertz does work in the EOC and has been used for both for the bridge collapse. And we have to relay things through the DOT building, so then we're also counting on fiber, and we're counting on microwave to get communications out
and
of downtown.
I think we're going to we are looking at the last few slides and have read them, but I think we're going to, just because we spent so much time on the first part of it, and we still need to get Tim O'Malley. So I think if we could just have comments about the Southeastern Minnesota Public Safety Training Facility.
Madam Chair, my name is Steve Borchardt, Chair for Baldwin State County. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I will be brief in the interest of time. You've received my handout. This is the same document that I provided to Representative Tamar's committee. I wanted you to have the same thing. I know many of you had the opportunity to listen to me in Rochester last fall, so I certainly won't give you that whole presentation over again. I would like to draw your attention to the second to the last page. Excuse me?
Girl. Oh, that's Commissioner Leslie's daughter, Mary.
Oh. If I could draw your attention to the second to last page, Southeastern Minnesota Public Safety Personnel, and it shows how many volunteers we're talking about. That is particularly key to the need for Tier 2 regional facilities. Our volunteers need to be able to travel to the facility within an hour tops, and probably less than that. I have some fire departments in the southeast part of the state telling me that even an hour is going to be a problem for them. But the key word there is accessibility. And then if I could direct your attention to the final page. It shows where the facilities are located around the state right now, and you'll note what is in southeast Minnesota at the current time. Now, why is this important? Again, the word accessibility. Anybody who's ever hunted, anybody that's ever got up and checked through their house in the middle of the night because they heard something go thump, and they were concerned that this one really did go thump this time, and you feel that adrenaline go up, and you feel your respirations accelerate, and your heart rate accelerate. And we know that when your heart rate and your respirations accelerate to maximum levels, cognition goes out the window. We're asking our volunteer firefighters, ambulance drivers, and officers, part-time and full-time officers out in our rural areas, to perform intricate, complex physical activities during the most harrowing times in their lives, when they are the most scared and when they are the least able to cognitively noodle their way through a given situation they find themselves in. If you'll indulge me for just a moment, if you're a firefighter and you are out at that fire at 10 degrees in the farmhouse, 10 degrees above zero on a wintry night at the farmhouse, and you go inside that farmhouse and route to the second floor to rescue the baby in the back bedroom, and you can't see your hand in front of your face because the smoke is so deep. If your self-contained breathing apparatus malfunctions halfway up that stairs, that is not the time that you have the opportunity to noodle your way through how you fix that thing. Ditto for if you're a volunteer ambulance driver and driving to a serious accident in the middle of a blizzard in a one-ton vehicle that you rarely pilot because you've never had the opportunity to have it on a skid pad, to drive it in an intricate maneuverability kind of course. The only training you've had is on your town's streets at 7 in the morning on a Sunday where there's a lack of traffic. And now we expect you to drive this thing in those difficult circumstances with your adrenaline on high in an unfamiliar circumstance. How do we overcome that? Well, we overcome that with repetition. Because we know that the only way you build instinctiveness is through repetition. We inherently accept that notion when it comes to athletics. Every one of us knows that you're not going to get your handicap down without playing golf several times a week. None of us would think to have our children or grandchildren participate in a hockey or baseball or any other kind of team that was going to practice four times a year. But that's what we do with law enforcement, that's what we do with fire, and that's what we do with our EMS folks. We have a sheet of ice, indoor ice, in just about every community in this state of 10,000 people or more. We have $1 million football stadium in just about every community in this state of over 10,000 people or more, because we inherently know that for a lot of kids to have the opportunity to play enough to get the repetitions they need for the actions to become instinctive so they can be competitive on game day, that they need those repetitions. But we don't apply the same model to public safety. And it's probably on us as public safety leaders that we haven't been demanding enough of ourselves in that regard, because we're asking our people to be near perfect with physical responses during the most harrowing times in their lives. And it takes accessibility. That's the only way that's going to work. I understand the discussion that's been had here about fear of overduplication and having too many of these kinds of facilities. But I would ask you to set that aside, or at least keep it in proportion to the notion of accessibility. Because the more firefighters from Spring Grove and Caledonia and Wells that we can get in a burn facility for repeat exercises, not just up to Ripley to expose them to it one time in 4 or 5 years, but to a facility several times a year so they can get the repetitions they need for it to be instinctive, so when their back is against the wall and their life is on the line, they don't have to think their way through the right response. So I'd ask you to keep that in mind as you negotiate these very difficult decisions. The fact that you're seeing so many proposals this year is because the need is that dire. And it's that dire statewide.
And I think everyone's feeling that around the state, too. But it's also why we want to make sure that we talk about this, think about this, and make the right decision. So we're going to get the BCA up here. We got into the discussion a little bit the other day, and then maybe there will be some concluding questions
can
if we
have...
Representative Regini?
Yes, just one quick question. One of the dangers we have as public officials is... preparing for the last disaster. I mean, the war planners do that too. They plan for the last war. We had in our energy committee, Representative Hilty had some of the most powerful testimony I have heard this year about the probably the next real emergency we will have to face is an interruption in energy supply, particularly oil. So something that doesn't happen in Minnesota, happens way outside of our state, and that the price of oil skyrockets. Do you have a management plan for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilgenius, that is part of our critical infrastructure protection plan. And so we understand that it's not the things that are in the state of Minnesota that could be our hazards, but it is things like the electrical grid. It is things like the fact that our pipelines all go to the same storage area in very high, densely populated critical areas. So we are aware of that. The federal government, it's a federal oversight because it is more regionally and nationally based than in the state of Minnesota, but we are right on top of that nationally and are doing some planning for that with our local communities.
Okay. I think it was... just because it happens on a national level doesn't mean the consequences won't be entirely local.
Right.
So I want to be have a very sharp answer here. If we had a major disruption in our oil supply, do you have a plan not just for major facilities but for Minnesotans into the middle of winter?
No. Madam Chair, no.
Good thing for the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
please come forward. Sorry to have been so slow in getting to this point. I misread the agenda for just a little bit. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We got into this issue the other day a little bit when Representative Tamar was presenting his bill. But since we're taking a look at the whole thing, having you here is
the next disaster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the BCA, and I welcome the opportunity to present the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board report. I'm joined by Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gartner, who was on the committee that helped put this report together. We have done this presentation a couple of times together. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes, but I would ask you, we can do it in whatever amount of time you tell me. If you want to tell me to move it faster, we will.
We don't have that much time, so maybe rather than presentation, sort of to get a sense of, I mean, it's really Michael's committee that looks at the details of this. I think what we're concerned more about is the capital expenditure and the arguments why or why not to limit ourselves in terms of capital expenditure. I think the issue, for example, for us was because we invested in a BCA facility, if we begin to build other forensic laboratories, what are the pros and cons? Have we maximized use of the laboratories there? I mean, it's really, that's the piece of it, very targeted to say, what would your advice be to us as we think about capital expenditure, not so much programming.
Okay. Madam Chair, with your permission, maybe what I do is I spend about 2 minutes highlighting a couple of elements here, and then the county attorney could do the same in a minute or two, and then we maybe have time for any specific questions you would have. There are three recommendations that came out of this report. The first one is that there is a need for increased capacity overall. We looked at the background of what's going on in forensic science and law enforcement and prosecution today and decided that as a group, the courts, the defense bar, the prosecutors, the law enforcement, and academia around this committee said, yes, we need to increase capacity. To answer one of your questions directly, could that be done by making more use of the BCA current facility? It could be. We could handle more staff at the BCA and reduce capacity to some extent by doing that. The second recommendation is that there are merits to regionalization. There are elements, factors, and benefits of regionalization that wouldn't be present if it was only a lab in St. Paul. Those need to be balanced. Those need to be weighed on the cost benefits, obviously. But there are a few reasons why those make some sense, and those are listed in the second section of the report. Dealing with mostly access for prosecutors, access for defense attorneys, access for law enforcement to the labs. There's anecdotal evidence there'd be increased submissions. And then also the training and quality in a region. Just as the labs, or as the training facilities you talked about, our lab in Bemidji has resulted in better relations and I think overall better quality law enforcement, submission of evidence, working with the courts and the defense bar and the prosecutors up in northern Minnesota. The third section of the report deals with the specifics you're asking about. If the legislature were to make a decision between this facility, that proposal, the last section, which the county attorney will go over briefly, is lays out several factors that it's the committee's recommendation that if state funds are used, here are those concerns that should be balanced by the legislature in deciding which location a lab should be in. At the heart of all that is that there is a need, the committee believes, to have it be really a comprehensive statewide approach. Not to say this is good here for this one reason, but how does this fit into not only a statewide approach in the next 2 or 3 years, but in a couple of decades, that this made sense as we expanded out. And maybe with that, I'll turn over to county attorney. Susan Gartner is the county attorney here in Ramsey County. She is an expert in not only prosecuting a lot of cases, but certainly ones with forensic evidence. She was the first prosecutor to bring DNA before a jury here in Minnesota, and was the first prosecutor, I think, in the nation to exonerate a previously convicted person based on DNA evidence by having that evidence reviewed. So she certainly has a wealth of experience in the use of evidence in the court proceedings.
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to emphasize what Mr. O'Malley touched on, and that is that this truly is a consensus document of all the stakeholders in the criminal justice system, prosecutors, judges, defense bar, everyone. And our goal, obviously, is justice, and that, I think, is reflected by our recommendations. As Mr. O'Malley touched on, certainly issues like where the population is, where the crime is, where existing resources are, accessibility is certainly something that the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board recommends be looked at. Some things that might be specific to the particular issue of forensic laboratory needs have to do with the issue of operational governance and scientific independence. As a career prosecutor and as someone who's been involved on the issues of forensic laboratory integrity across this nation, I would say that one thing that is very critical to any expenditure is that scientific independence be preserved in any forensic laboratory setting. One of the reasons that forensic science, DNA in particular, is so compelling to juries is because it is perceived of as science, presented to them by scientists who don't have a dog in the fight, if you will. And I can't emphasize enough really how important that is. Part of scientific independence depends on governance models. Who does the scientist report to? Does the scientist report to another scientist? That's an important piece of it. Or does the scientist report to an elected official, which might bring into play the question of whether or not this is this finding of has integrity. And so the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board very much emphasizes that those kinds of issues be looked at. Related to that is accreditation. The credibility, again, of this kind of testimony does depend on the quality of the laboratory's procedures generally. The board recommended mandatory accreditation as a policy for expenditure of statewide funds, again, for that reason, upholding the integrity of the evidence itself. And part of that integrity, of course, relates to the training of the scientists. The board recommended that forensic scientists should be certified and goes into some specifics about what their baseline training should be. Also related to the individual scientists themselves, the board recommended that compensation parity be a consideration in the expenditure of statewide funds. In other words, it takes a while, a good chunk of time, for a scientist to be trained, a significant investment by the BCA or whatever laboratory is doing it, and we don't want a situation where the BCA is essentially training scientists for laboratories across the state. That's a very brief overview of some of the things that we talked about, but I want to say that what goes on in any laboratory in a state makes a difference for everyone in the state. In the Houston laboratory situation has been a black eye to all laboratories. And so what is, you know, our interest to say the Ramsey County prosecutors and whatever happens in a laboratory, you know, in another part of the state, the interest is the integrity and the reputation of the science as a whole.
Except Ducky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the info. I appreciate the report. But again, to address this committee's concerns, since we've been out looking at them, there's no question. The Tri-County up in Anoka, Sherburne, those folks are expressing needs. City of Minneapolis is expressing needs, but it all seems to go back to the BCA lab, which we built, and then we said there's still room to expand, and there's room to add personnel. All these people are coming in telling us, well, you know, there's not a lot of triage that goes on there. Our samples get in line and wait. We've got holds. Prosecutors are telling us we can't move to solve these crimes or prosecute. Can't drop off samples after 4:30 in the afternoon. We have no business on weekends. And so now they're all coming and saying we need better service, and it appears the only way we can get it is by us doing it ourselves. And you said put them where the population is. The seven county metro area is what's asking for more, and you're already here. So that's what we're struggling with here is Minneapolis, Anoka County have real needs that are not being met by BCA. So it's, you know, I appreciate the uniformity and that we don't want, folks competing for jobs and we want quality, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think we're answering the basic premise from BCA, which is, and we're not even talking about rural Minnesota yet, you know, where we're driving and cruising and trying to get samples in and, you know, in some of our more deep rural counties, what in the world do we do at that point if we can't get it done here in the Twin Cities? So I don't think we've answered the questions yet, and I know we're out of time.
He has summarized the discussion of the last few months, I think. That's the struggle with...
So again, do we invest more in you? Do we expand? Do we add personnel? Do you get more hours in, more weekends in? Do you satisfy the needs of our law enforcement community out there? Or do we start doing these regional facilities and let them out? They're going to pay for them. They're going to operate them, the counties. It's not a state cost other than building. So from our standpoint, for budgetary reasons, doesn't sound like a bad deal.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Malley.
It's the perfect question. I would agree with that. What I would say is that we have not at the BCA, or I don't think the Department of Public Safety has said this proposal is better than that one, you should do this, you should do that. I would tell you factually that we have never had a piece of evidence turned into the BCA that was not analyzed. Our turnaround time has not met the 30-day goal that was set a year ago. We are at a 56-day average turnaround time. However, I had a case yesterday where a prosecutor called me and said, we have an urgent, can we get it done? I called her at 3:30 today, or 2:30 today, right before coming in here, and told her we got it done in 24 hours. If it's a kidnapping case, the average turnaround time is 19 days for all of the evidence in that case. Homicides take 30 days. There are some burglaries where a person's maybe in custody and there's no violent crime that can take up to 7 months, 6 months. So where do you draw that line? I would tell you this. There is a need for increased capacity. I would tell you that the BCA could handle more scientists. We have room for at least 25 or more scientists between the Bemidji and the St. Paul facility, and that's without going to shift work, without going 24 hours. Why do we not go 24 hours now? We don't have staffing to do it. We have sufficient staffing to handle the capacity at the most efficient rate by working Monday through Friday. To go beyond that would require overtime or contractual costs of going to shifts that would actually be detrimental to the turnaround time at this point.
The next chair is just walked into the room, so that means we've got to get out of here. But if closing comments from either of you, that is, he really has summarized kind of the heart of what this group has has struggled with as we've toured the state.
And I guess my closing comment, Madam Chair and members, would be this committee studied that very hard and tried to come up with some criteria, and in effect, we threw the ball back into your court. I understand that. But the committee decided, you know, we shouldn't really make that decision. It seems to me it's the legislature should decide, do you want to spend money on bonding for a regional one, or do you want to spend money on staffing at the BCA? Okay.
Anything further? Obviously, the guy who has to write the operations budget wouldn't have a strong view of how that would be answered, I would
think. I just ask you to look at the rider language that was included
okay.
in our bill.
Great.
Okay.
We'll look at the rider language.
And Madam Chair, members, the language that Representative Paymer is talking about, the BCA and this committee would be happy to take that on and report back again next year.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.